Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Welcome to The Lob podcast from These Football Times. My name is Gary Thacker, and this is Series 2 of Mount Rushmore, where invited guests choose the four players, one goalkeeper, one defender, one midfielder, and one forward, who, in their opinion, deserve to be immortalised with their images crafted into stone in their team's very own version of Mount Rushmore. Before we meet today's guests, though, I'd like to introduce my co-hosts. Firstly, bottom right, so I'm looking at the picture, is Stevie Scragg. How are you doing, Steve?
Oh, very well tonight, Gary. Very well tonight. Looking forward to this. And I think any time, kind of like an old series, kind of like bobs back to the surface, it's always a special kind of podcast.
Yeah, we had a lot of positive reaction from the first series, so we were almost obliged to do a second one. I understand you had a little bit of good fortune yesterday.
I did. Yes, indeed. I know nothing about horses, but a tradition at our house, it casts back to my mum being a kid, is putting kind of like a couple of pennies each way on a horse for the Grand National. And I know nothing about horses. I don't think I've ever bet on another horse race. And I picked it out because connotations to a former Liverpool captain, Ron Yates, and I can't even remember what the name of the horse was now. But it came in anyway. And I backed it on Saturday morning at about 66 to 1. Nice £2 each way, making me feel like a grandma, which was great. It was a lovely surprise. Put it that way.
Well done, buddy. Congratulations. And our second co-host is Mr. Aidan Williams. Now I'm going to ask Aidan, did he choose the winner of the Grand National as well?
No, I definitely did not. Now we have the same tradition as Stephen does, and my 9-year-old son actually, he's won for the last 3 years in a row. So, you know, I was expecting big things from him, but no, we all failed this year. It was a bit of a disaster. So I'm not quids in. However, I am very much looking forward to this on a more positive note, because yes, it's the start of a new series. Like we say, it's one that was hugely popular last time around. So many people wanting to get their team a mention that couldn't fit into the first series. And I think tonight we've got one that we wouldn't necessarily have thought of. Ourselves, certainly, and that makes it all the more interesting.
Yeah, I mean, this series is very much in the mould of the last series as well. Is lots of different clubs in lots of different situations, lots of different circumstances, but the players are nonetheless the worthy for that. So let's go and have a word with our guest today. So, Mr. Matt Riley, can you introduce yourself, please? Tell us who you've chosen.
Yeah, great to see you guys. My team is Exeter City. Often the bridesmaid in the League Two playoffs, rarely the bride. Sometimes the headline grabbers when Michael Jackson becomes the director and sends us into non-league oblivion. But a trust-run club, one of the very few in English and Welsh football, and one that I'm really proud to be season ticket holder, trust member, a volunteer, and a sponsor of one of the women's team called Zoe Watkins, but no relation to Ollie, unfortunately. So, yeah, Exeter City. Very proud to be associated with them, despite the less than glamorous games that we often see.
Okay. So before we just talk about the specific players, was it easy? Was it difficult? Was one of the positions the most difficult one? Or how did you sort of go about it? Because in the past, we've had people who said, well, I've only chosen players I've seen play in real life.
Yeah.
Or I've only chosen players from a certain era. Yeah. Or that they've won something. So did you have any criteria? Did you find it easy or difficult to choose your players?
To be honest, Gary, there's very little logic and an awful lot of being swept away on the season that we've had. Two of my four are in the current team because something magical is happening at Exeter City. There are players like how the goalie that I chose and the midfielder that I chose that have knocked around non-league football and lower league football. And they've come to Exeter and everything has just gelled. So you mentioned Cliff Bastian before we started, Gary. He is a legend for the club, but I've been totally and completely biased in the experiences that we've had this year of seeing two of the lads being part of my four. So that was my criteria. I'm probably going to be shot down by all my fellow fans at City, but it really has been magic. I mean, this year we played well and won. We've played okay and drawn. We've played really badly and found a way to win. And it's all been to do with this kind of magic that's been happening with again, players that other teams discarded. I mean, when you get discarded by Colchester, as one of my players were, you know that you're probably not going to be getting up to Barcelona standards anytime soon.
Yeah, I mean, it's great. And you know, one of the key issues is that this sort of series is it doesn't matter why it is. It's somebody's personal opinion. So, you know, you've got your right to pick your player. So that's great. So let's start with the goalkeeper. So before we go on to your choice, who was close?
So who was close? One of the kind of the most successful goalkeepers we've ever had, actually, is a guy called Christy Pym, who, funnily enough, we played against a couple of weeks. So he played 151 games for City. He then went to Peterborough, played in League One, and then even up to the Championship. If rumours are true, which I hear on the terraces, he had a disagreement with Alex Ferguson's son involving some projectiles. And now he's back with Stevenage, who are flirting with non-league football. Now, he's an unusual goalkeeper, and he's not very tall, but he's incredibly dynamic, and he's got really, really fast hands. So I saw him play a good number of games, and when we were really struggling for good players, he often kind of bailed us out with his athleticism and his and the way that he ran the defence. So it's kind of a shame to see him with a team like Stevenage that are really struggling. But he did an awful lot for us. We got a few quid for him that just about kept us afloat when he went to Peterborough. And hopefully he'll bounce back. But he's a really good, athletic, organisational goalie. So he was my sort of runner-up, if you like.
Okay. Before we go into your choice, just chuck this out to the guys. You mentioned about having to sell him. And obviously with the club in the sort of lower leagues, this happens quite often. So how important do you reckon, Steve, is it important to keep the young promising players as long as you can at a club such as Exeter, when you, although they're doing a fantastic season this season and fighting for promotion, but it's difficult, isn't it, in the moneyed world of today's football?
Yeah, I think it's more difficult now than ever. You know, the big clubs, Premier League clubs, Championship clubs as well, you know, they're very, very quick at hoovering up young talent. You know, the networks stretch far and wide. You know, we've even seen it with overseas players of a very young age picked up and brought over and implemented within academy systems. So, you know, any kind of outrageous talents are, you know, it's very rare that they slip through the net now. So, yes, you know, within that, you know, if an Exeter, any team, you know, in the lower echelons who finds, you know, a piece of gold or someone who's been discarded, you know, often, you know, will be the case. You know, there's someone who's misunderstood at another club or has run into trouble and been discarded. You know, and I tell you what, I often find, you know, when you come to do research over players and teams or whatever it is you're writing, you often find that certain players, though, will, I don't know, automatically connect to certain clubs. It's strange, though. You can have a nomadic player sometimes who might run to about a dozen clubs, you know, especially down the divisions. They might run 12, 15 clubs or so, but when you run your fingers through the games and goals that they've scored, they will repetitively return to a certain club or one or two clubs where they just seem to shine, and they can't quite take off elsewhere. And they're the type of dream players that you're scratching around for now at that type of level. You know, I mean, probably gone are the days when, you know, Scunthorpe United on the brink of dropping out the Football League. Are going to find a Ray Clements and a Kevin Keegan within such a short proximity of one another.
Yeah, fair comment. Aidan, thoughts on the same thing?
Yeah, I think there's another strand to it as well, which obviously in modern times, as you say, the big clubs hoarding the talent or better identifying it from the off is for clubs of Exeter's level, possibly loans from higher up, is a way they can... they can get such talent without having the commitment and the financial commitment and all the issues that come with it. I think that's going to become increasingly important for teams at these levels. If it's not already now, it makes it a little bit unsustainable, I guess, in terms of your squad building. But I think that's the realities of modern football, unfortunately. But that still doesn't mean that clubs of League One, League Two, non-league can't develop their own. And I think we'll have a couple of examples of that tonight, of players who have come through youth setups of lower clubs and still find a way through to the higher leagues. It is still very much achievable. Whether they come in through being just missed by a bigger club or as a cast-off, like Stephen says, those who haven't quite made it, or those who just happen to be local boys who've come through the scheme and worked their way up and come good. It's very much still possible. It's just harder, I think. But yeah, equally, there's the loans as well, where you, well, as you know, Gary, your club loans out more players than anyone else has even got on their books. And that's how some other clubs build their seasons.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that might become relevant a bit later on as we go along. And I think having to sell players to survive and working on loan players is going to be a fairly consistent theme in this discussion. So, okay, Matt, so kick us off with the goalkeeper. Who's your choice for goalkeeper?
Well, I mean, Aidan set me up really nicely, actually, because this is a player who's actually on the books of Sheffield Wednesday. He's rattled around 4 or 5 low-league teams. He's been in and out. He even was signed by our arch enemies, Plymouth Argyle, but luckily he didn't play, so it wasn't too much of a problem there. His name's Cameron Dawson. He's a very different goalie to Christy Penn. He's 6'4". He's got 16 clean sheets this year. He's a very kind of, he's a big bluff Yorkshireman. He's very kind of aggressive in the way that he organises a defence. And I think he's just been fantastic. Now, he's probably not the best goalie the world's ever seen, but again, this ties into this idea that he's found, a little bit like Steve was setting up as well, he's found the place where he belongs. We've got some very good defenders. There's a couple I think are going to leave. I know one of them's is on his way to Sunderland, but with him, he's found his niche. People, the fans are really friendly with him. The players work really well with him. He's a good, solid, aggressive goalkeeper. And for me, he's the best I've seen. And as we were talking before, Gary, I'm sure he's not the best he's ever been, but I just love the fact that I think he's been on loan at 7 teams and he's been playing 3-4 games or no games like Plymouth Argyle. He's come to City, he's found his niche, and we love him. And I'm a big fan of his.
Okay. On the subject of loan players, Steve, coming into as Matt said, rattling around other clubs, how important is it, especially for a goalkeeper, to have an identity with the team? And is there a danger that the success almost becomes counterproductive in as much as he's likely to be called back or sold on by his the club who owns his registration?
Yeah, I think it's one of those variables, isn't it? You do get players sometimes who'll go on loan to clubs and then they might go elsewhere. A club might sell them for a fee that's beyond the loan club, but eventually, maybe a few years down the line, they end up tripping back to where football's been good. I think for any footballer, they just want a place. The best players. If you're a Lionel Messi, it's slightly different. But I think for kind of like your jobbing footballer, I think what we could call them, is they just want somewhere where they can enjoy the football. I always remember talking to Drew. We had Drew Broughton on podcast, and he said that out of the 300 odd games he played, he could only really say he walked off a pitch and really felt like he'd smashed it out the stadium about 30 times. And there'll be players across the whole career that probably relate to that. And if they find a club where that happens more often than not, then that's a place they want to be. I think the loan system, it's crucial to so many clubs. But yes, I think a lot of clubs will go into it realistically as well. If they will know that they can't afford to buy that player on a permanent basis, and they know they're going to get them for a short burst. But within that, the player comes along and probably he knows that as well. So, and it's the shop window. It's the chance to impress, whether that's to go back to the mother club to get a chance of playing or to move on somewhere else that might be a division or two higher. It's a mutually beneficial situation.
Sure. Aidan, so to you, Matt just described how important the goalkeeper's been this season. I mean, when you've got a team fighting for promotion, the defence is key, and the key element of the defence is obviously the goalkeeper. So when you're in a situation such as Exeter and the chance to cut to sign somebody on loan, as opposed to perhaps bringing a younger player through, there must be a balance in making that decision.
Yeah, absolutely, definitely. And I think what you're getting in this situation, because as you say, he's a player registered with a team two leagues higher, or currently two leagues higher. That might change soon, Matt, hopefully for you. So what you should be getting is a slightly higher level of quality. And what I noted down what Matt was saying there, describing Cameron Dawson there, is aggressive and organisation of the defence. That's something that, I mean, all goalkeepers need that, obviously. But I think somebody who has played, even if it's only marginally or a few times at a higher level, or has experience of the demands of a higher level and the coaching setup of a higher level, even if they haven't made that full breakthrough there yet, I think they should bring slightly greater level of that to a team. That would be the expectation. And I think that's, I'm sure, what a club like Exeter were thinking when they looked at Cameron Dawson as somebody to bring in, as opposed to blooding a fresh youngster. Now, they obviously have done that in other aspects of the team, because we're going to come on to several of those. But goalkeeper, it's the position where if you make a mistake, it more likely as not, it's a goal. So it carries an awful lot of responsibility. And I think, you know, youth needs its chance, sure. But there's no substitute for a little bit of experience or higher level abilities. And in this case, I guess it's the latter rather than the experience that has come in and seen Exeter. But, you know, somebody who is a goalkeeper who's utterly dominant, that's something that resonates with fans. Definitely, because, you know, you see somebody who's in control. They may not appear calm all the time, but it's kind of giving it an assurance. You know, they may appear angry sometimes, but it gives a bit of assurance to those in front of them. And then in turn, that gives an assurance to those watching on, that you feel confident in that person because they look like they're in control. They look like they are organizing those around them, sorting things out, making sure everybody knows their tasks. You get similar with central defenders and so on. Those positions that are quite pivotal further back, good organization is something that's key. And I think that's clearly what Matt has seen in Cameron. And I think that's something that the benefit you would get from loaning somebody from slightly higher up the pyramid bring, as opposed to, as you say there, the alternative might have been somebody young or somebody they've got from a similar level who they've been able to transfer in. That should give slightly more assurance at that key position.
Okay, so we've established our number one face on the Exeter City version of Mount Rushmore, and that's the goalkeeper, Cameron Dawson.
Gary, before we leave goalkeepers, can I throw in a story about an Exeter goalkeeper?
I don't know. Is it a good story or a bad story? That's the question.
It's a good one. This is going back a long way, because one of the things I know about Exeter City, other than the fact that they've got a fantastic stadium name, which I would say, of course, is that they played Brazil in a friendly game before Brazil had played an official international. Exeter played them. They'd also played Argentina on a tour. Now, the goalkeeper at the time, a guy called Dick Pym, he unfortunately missed the Brazil game, but he played against Argentina. He was injured, but he came back and he brought a parrot back from Brazil with him. This parrot became part of the furniture at St. James Park in Exeter. When it died, it was buried underneath the goal. Exeter went on a losing run, so they dug the thing up and moved it elsewhere, and the curse was lifted.
Well, until Michael Jackson came, then it came back, I think.
So for a while, I suppose, Exeter was sick as parrots, I suppose.
Right? Hey, boom, nicely set up.
Sorry about that. Excellent stuff. Another Dick Pym kind of claim to fame as well is he moved on to Bolton Wanderers, played for them in the 1920s and won three FA Cup winners' medals. He was in goal that day for Bolton in 1923, that first Wembley FA Cup final. So, you know, a storied character.
But he doesn't resonate with modern fans quite the same, because we're going back a century here or more than a century.
Yeah, yeah.
Here.
City played Brazil 100 years later as well at St. James's Park, yeah.
I think actually as well, that's interesting, just to throw something else in. That game when Exeter played Argentina, I think was the first time Argentina played with numbers on the shirts. And I'm trying to remember the guy. Our good friend Dr. Pete Watson did tell me who the first guy to wear number 10 for Argentina. That slipped my mind, but yeah, I think it was the first time they played in the numbers. Anyway, moving forward, so we're going to go on to defenders. So there again, let's start with the near miss then, Matt.
My first choice is one of the next three were all born and bred in Exeter, all went through the academy system. One of the striker that you may have heard about before, he actually was rejected by the under-9s, but my near miss is a guy called Dean Moxie. Although he got sent off after an hour in the 2020 playoff finals as we got battered by Northampton, he played against Manchester United in 2005. Now, if we hadn't had a draw or a game and then a draw at Old Trafford against them, the club 99% would have gone bust. So he was one of these players, one of the lads I think Steve was saying earlier. He played for us nearly 180 times, 176 times. He then went and played for Derby, Palace, Bolton. Then he came back to us to play another 96 games. And you could see how he adapted his game. He was a good, strong, physical player. He'd learned so much from those higher league teams. And one of the things Aidan was saying about the Cam Dawson as well is he brought the younger players on as well. He's actually playing with one of our rivals now, Torquay United, in the non-league. But he was a kind of a great example of how City's academy can bring people through the whole system, can give them a career, and then can welcome them back as they start to, let's be honest, tail off their career a little bit. Very intelligent player, apart from when he got sent off at Wembley. A very intelligent player.
Yeah. Oh. Okay, so who's your choice then, Matt? Who's in the number one slot?
So the number one slot is someone that you might know, Gary, a young lad born in Exeter whose dad worked for Arsenal but somehow persuaded him to sign for that blue team in London. We weren't very happy with the contract that we had because there weren't any sell-on clauses, but I saw Ethan Ampadu play. Now, it's amazing, really, because he only actually played 8 times for City. Ethan Ampadu, as a 15-year-old, I think it's 15 years, 10 months and 26 days, he bossed experienced, okay, League Two, but experienced players when he wasn't even 16, and they all listened. And I always remember that season because that's the first time we got to Wembley, and he couldn't play because he had homework for his exams. And we lost, and we might not have lost if he played. As soon as I saw him play, and I've seen other players that have gone on to, you know, bigger careers we'll talk about later, I could see within 5 minutes that this lad was something special. And I have to say, again, Gary and I, we were talking about it before this, I'm really sad to see the way that his career is being really fractured, because when he left us, he went straight into the Wales team, essentially, started to play for Chelsea, and he has something magic about him. I mean, physically at 15, I've got teenage children, I've never seen anyone physically put up with a League Two standard where you get hit or you have to hit, and it just was water off a duck's back. And of course, he was selected very quickly. His dad asked him not to sign a contract with us, which is really disappointing. We got £1 million, 1.2, but he was, for me, he's probably the best player of his age I'll ever see in my lifetime at Exeter, which may not mean a lot to some people, but he was exceptional.
It's interesting that I think Chelsea signed him. We played Exeter in a cup game, I think, and obviously impressed the Chelsea coaching hierarchy, and they sort of moved to sign very quickly. That's Stevie, Ethan Ampadu.
Yep, good shout. Yep, I've seen him play. I mean, I've been watching him a little bit this season in Italian football, and he has. He's impressed me. You know, I think there's certain players who have a presence about them. You know, I think that's a phrase. You know, it's on a massive scale. You know, you're talking about a Virgil van Dijk, but you know, you see it throughout the leagues, throughout the divisions, even down to the non-leagues, and there's certain players that just exude a certain confidence and it is a presence. You know, that's what it is. You know, and some players don't fulfil that presence. You know, yeah, and back to the Drew Broughton podcast we did. I always remember him talking about how he helped Stephen Colker. And Stephen Colker, yeah. And he was at Liverpool for a very short period of time on loan. We were struggling for a defender, and we brought him in on loan. And he only played 3 games. I think one of those was half a match. But you could still see that kind of assurance on the ball and that kind of exuding that calm aura about them. And Ampadu's, you know, from what I've seen of him, you know, he's another player that has that kind of, I don't know, it's almost like the shrouded in a confidence. And, you know, in a way, it's almost like they play in a matrix almost. You know, they see a past, they see danger before it starts to materialise. It's that type of, you know, aura about it. And I completely get what Matt, where Matt's coming from on this one.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, just coming to you, Aidan, here's a guy who, you know, as Matt says, he played 8 first-team games for Exeter. And, you know, and obviously massively impressed Matt, and obviously massively impressed the Chelsea coaching hierarchy in the game we played against Exeter in the Cup as well, and was whisked away from Exeter to South West London at a tender age. And then he spent time with Leipzig and Germany and Sheffield United, and now he's Venezia in Italy, which, I mean, you know, let's face it, this isn't, you know, second-rate football, but you just wonder whether... Which alternative path could his career have taken if he'd have stayed with Exeter?
Yeah, that's the thing, because this is so young. He's still only 21 now, and he's gone to all those places you've said. And he's almost played more for Wales than he has for all the clubs put together, pretty much. Now, this is, yeah, when you come through at 15 and then he was sold to Chelsea at 16, that, you know, I'm sure, yes, he showed all that talent and all that confidence and calm and so on, but that seems a bit young to be making such a leap, because through no fault of Chelsea's, you know, his opportunity is going to be very limited at that age. He's just going to be one of a number of prospects at a club like Chelsea. That's just the realities of it. Chelsea, I guess, were not, maybe taking a gamble is a bit strong, but, you know, just thinking, well, here's a gem that we've spotted. Let's get him for us just in case he turns out to be, to continue to develop and become a real gem. And it's a shame for a club like Exeter. But as you say, is it a shame for someone like Ethan Ampadu? I don't know, because he's obviously, you know, his career isn't going that badly in terms of where he's ending up. But could he have spent longer to develop? I guess that's the thing. Another year or two, I guess, Exeter fans would have absolutely loved that. You know, he does have a bit of a calm confidence about him, which is what you need in that position. You need a bit of confidence and presence about you to have dreadlocks like that at such a young age as well, if you're going to be playing football. And that's something that stands out. You know, it's like somebody who bleaches their hair blonde or something like that, you know, or has bright pink boots. If you're going to do this, you're going to be noticed. You're going to be seen. So what you do is never going to be hidden, because you're drawing attention, extra attention to yourself. And, you know, that's a little bit what he's like, but it seems to settle him. It seems to be okay with it. That's good. He's part of a crop. I know he's not Welsh. It's family ties, and he's obviously an Exeter lad. But when it comes to the Welsh team, he's one of a number of young players that have come through. You know, I know that the big stars are a little bit older and so on, but there's a decent crop of younger talent for Wales, and he's one of them, and he's sort of settled into that squad. I think, you know, to play the international tournaments that he has, and international experience that he has at such a young age, shows the confidence that they've got in him as well, that he's able to perform. Okay, sure, it's not technically as high a level as the Premier League and Chelsea's level, but in terms of the pressure that it brings on somebody so young when it's one-off occasions, it's quite intense, and he's shown he can cope with that to a large extent. And I think that's much to his credit, much to Exeter's credit for bringing him through. But yes, I think his career, he's probably not complaining living in Venice and playing for Venezia, to be honest, but I think his career, in terms of his development progression to become the player he could become, another year or two at Exeter might have been no bad thing.
Yeah. Just a quick one on that matter, on a sort of a semi-linked thing there. Does the fact that Ampadu has played for Wales, rather than being in a queue to get an England cap, actually have done him lots of favours in his development, do you think?
I think so, in terms of the momentum that he could build. You know, he made such an impression in that Welsh team. I forget the name of the captain at the time, but he said, I can retire because I know Ethan can take over, almost the first game that he played. So I think he gained a lot of momentum by getting into that Welsh squad. And again, I definitely, you know, agree with what Aidan said, but I just feel that that momentum has been dissipated a little bit by what's happened before, because, again, I know it's League Two, but when I saw him play, the way that he read a game, I mean, my 15-year-old could hardly read a book, let alone read a game, but he could read a game to such a high level that League Two players were, you'd see League Two players thinking, what on earth is this? He's playing a different game to me. And again, you could say, well, it's League Two, but we have had a lot of players that come down with really good skill sets. It's just that they're coming towards the end of their career. So yeah, I think the Welsh thing really helped him. And that was the boosting point that I really thought would be, now he can start establishing himself at Chelsea. But again, it's not too bad to live and near play football in Venice, but I just feel there's more there. And I feel like the last 3 or 4 years, he's treading water is too harsh, but there's more development that could have happened with regular, you know, hard first team play.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you know, whether he's playing for Venice or Chelsea, he's still worthy of his place on Exeter City's merit rush more so. We'll put him in the defender's position and we'll move into midfield.
Yeah.
I was looking forward to doing some research this morning about Exeter players, and there's been some really outstanding players who play for Exeter, not for very long. Lee Sharp played a few games for Exeter. David Platt as well. But so who was your near misses then for the midfield position?
He's not well known, lads, but he's called Matt Grimes, and he's a word you don't often use in League Two, which is a classy midfielder. He played 58 times for us, and then he played 179 for Swansea. He's another of those players. One of the things about Exeter, even though we may not be particularly successful, is we have a style of play that goes all the way through the academy to the first team, and that is played on the floor. The trouble has been that we haven't had the money for a good pitch. So we're playing it along the floor and we can't control it. Now, this year, because of the money we got from one of the lads we sold that we'll talk about later, we've been able to build a new stand and also have a new pitch. And so people like Matt Grimes, if they'd have had the pitch, they'd have been, you know, even more effective. But obviously, we were really proud of him that, you know, nearly 180 performances for Swansea. Obviously, his career has tailed off after that, but in a good way. You know, he's provided a lot to the team. So for me, a guy called Matt Grimes, not a household name, but he stands up for a lot of what Exeter is about because he's born and bred in Exeter. Again, he's come through the whole academy, and he's got the DNA stamp of what Exeter try to do. You know, we've seen teams this year or every year that just hoof it forward. Even though it would probably be a good idea for us to do that at this level, we never do. And even if we're punished for not doing it, we have that DNA of play. And that's something I'm really proud about. And that's the kind of player that Matt Grimes was. He was a midfield general, highly intelligent, very spatially aware. And he had a real kind of orchestration about his game.
Sure. Before we go on to the next, I just want to throw very quickly at the guys. You know, Matt mentioned there about this guy was a skilled midfield player and potentially compromised by the condition of pitches they play on in that division. How sort of detrimental to the development of players do you think that is? Gus, I'll go to you first, Aidan.
Yeah, I guess it has to be when in terms of the style. They probably came through at a lower level in youth teams and so on, playing a lot of games on or training on 3G a lot of the time, potentially where obviously the surface is perfect, if slightly not real, in the way the ball rolls and bounces. But it's always flat and short. I'm sure even a League Two pitch isn't quite the mud bath it used to be in the 70s and 80s. I'm quite sure, you know, that without the riches of the Premier League, that they've still moved on somewhat since then. But it's never conducive to an elegant style of play. It's more dangerous, I guess, in some ways, in terms of your touch, your technique, maybe it helps you develop them better because you can be surprised by how the ball lands at your feet or reaches you. Maybe it forces you to actually improve your technique in that way rather than knowing it's always going to come perfectly to you. There's potentially that side to it too. But in terms of the team and the style and so on, it has to affect how you can play as much as you might intend. And as Matt says, Exeter's approach through all their teams to play in this ball on the floor style. I'm sure there's occasions where they have to adapt it purely because the conditions that they're playing in.
Yeah. It's interesting, I suppose. I mean, you know, regardless of how good Exeter's pitch is, by definition, half the games the club plays are on somebody else's patch.
Well, yeah, exactly. And it could be a patch.
Yes. Newport used to be like that.
What do you think, Stevie? I mean, do you think that that sort of is it detrimental to players of that quality? Should teams play like Exeter play? Is it sort of almost a little bit self-defeating?
No, I wouldn't say it's self-defeating. I mean, the battle to win against your pitch has been a generational thing. You know, I can remember kind of like some Liverpool vintage seasons being played on awful pitches. Watching an episode of the Big Match Revisited the other day with my dad, Liverpool's 1981-82 season, probably the worst pitch I've seen at Anfield. And that was the year we came back from 12th to win the title. You can't let your pitch dictate the way you play. You know, you've got to prepare to play the way that your ethos is. But your pitch just has to catch up eventually. You know, it's up to your ground staff to find a way and the club to find the funds to let your ground staff, you know, create the pitch that is suitable for the players that you've got. You know, you've still got to go out there and play the football that you are, you know, wanting to play.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, for the book I'm working at the moment, the Ajax book, I was looking at some of the games Ajax played in the early 70s, and the football I played on pitches that were, you know, more resembling a playing field than the billiard tables you see on today. So,
and in a way, it can sharpen skills as well sometimes.
Yeah, you know,
there are kind of advantages here and there. You know, you can take a plus point by the fact that, you know, if you can master a poor football pitch, then come the game when you're playing on a carpet, you know, then it's got to be an absolute doddle for you.
Yeah. This is why they say so many street footballers are used to playing on uneven surfaces, get their skills developed.
It used to be a case of playing in small areas. I always remember John Aldridge saying it. You know, he fine-tuned his eye for goal by playing in his backyard, a very small kind of like a terrace backyard, with the ball bouncing back off the walls or back off the back of the house. And he played with a tennis ball as well. And, you know, by the time he was using like a size five regulation ball, it just felt like an absolute doddle to him, you know, I think that's why you often find a lot of modern training devices and stuff like that will often mimic, you know, some of the things that are mentioned by older players and the way that they grew up and fine tune the skills. You know, Liverpool famously used the sweat box, where, you know, it was basically four walls and the ball would bounce back off the wall. You had to control and then hit it against the next wall, and you'd be in that box with two other teammates. And if you could manage it for 2 minutes, then you were doing well. You know, something positive can come from something negative in that respect.
Yeah, good point. Yeah. So Matt Grimes is second choice. So who's going to be our midfield player on Exeter City's Mount Rushmore then, Matt?
Right, lads, this is totally irrational based on the fact that I love this guy to death. And last May, my wife and I went to Exeter Women against Plymouth Women because we sponsor a player. We got to the club bar and this lad and my parent and myself had a very good afternoon on the Thatcher's cider. And he was as good a lad at the end of it as he was at the beginning. This is another player that's been released by a lower league team, in this case, Colchester United. He plays with this infectious enthusiasm, but he has this fantastic off-the-ball intelligence. His name's Giovanni Brown. He's played for 5, 6, 7 teams, never quite made it. He's come to us. He's seen and felt the love, and he's scored some absolute banging goals this year. But it's that overall feeling of, at this level, some teams as Exeter have got better, have tried to park the bus, and he's able to break up their defensive structures and frailties. But when players are attacking us, he's got fantastic service, great power, great pace. Luckily, we've signed him up to another contract because he's just a completely different player than the one that was scratching around the leagues. A fantastic character as well. And that's another thing about all of the players that's made me completely biased, totally irrational, is that when you talk to them individually, they're good men first and they're good players second. And this lad, Giovanni, even when he comes on and everyone's in the zone, he's smiling, he's looking around, he's talking to people. But when he's got his game face on, he still enjoys it. And you just see that love. But it's that game intelligence that I absolutely love. And I'm often heard shouting my praises to him. from the stands at a game. So he's my kind of a player, my kind of a person, and he's one of many. I'll get a little bit of pushback from his fellow midfielder, a guy called Tim Dieng, but for me, it's a guy called Giovanni Brown.
Okay. I mean, for me, one thing that absolutely shines through there is the kinship between the supporter and a player, which you perhaps don't get at you know, in Premier League clubs or even, you know, higher than, you know, the Championship. Stevie, what do you reckon? How important is that to somebody like Giovanni Brown, who can inspire the fans in his matter, you know, who's consumed several glasses of cider in the bar, and it creates that kinship, doesn't it?
It does. You know, you said before, you know, you can get a player who can bounce from club to club and really struggle to find, you know, a path in what they're doing. And suddenly just everything drops into place one day at a club, and they just find a home. And, you know, this is exactly what it sounds like. You know, and I think what it comes down to is that you get a lot of football clubs that, I don't know, they almost try to play like a textbook football. And what they need is, you know, almost, I don't know, stereotype footballers or, you know, whatever it is, a stereotype midfielder or a stereotype defender, you know, cartoon characters almost. But then you get some football clubs that have a defined ethos and what they're trying to do and what their team structure is all about, and that it's a lot more fluid and it's a lot more flowing. And what it is that it's almost as much the personality of the player and, you know, what the person they are as much as the footballer. You know, some football clubs, you know, I'm looking, that's kind of Klopp's Liverpool. You know, it's about the person as much as it is about the player. You know, and not every football club deals that way. It's all about the player. You know, it's all about what the player can do on the pitch, and can they do this, I don't know, this set job that they've been given. You know, some football clubs are kind of like, you know, it's like working in a factory on a production line almost. Whereas other clubs, it's a completely different kettle of fish. And this is what it's sounding like at Exeter. And this, you know, Giovanni Brown, you know, he ticks the boxes clearly.
Yeah, it's interesting. We did the centre circle with Johnny Brick recently. He was saying he interviewed the guy at Watford, the youth team coach at Watford. And he said it's important. It's just as important to develop the man as it is to develop the player. So just moving to you, Aidan. I mean, so did you find this when you were sharing a few Newcastle Browns with Alan Shearer down in the two? The kinship. Did you find that, mate? it is difficult. Different, obviously, at a Premier League club. But even then, you can appreciate some of the things that Matt's just said, can't you?
Yeah, you have to find those in a different way, though, like those connections. Because no, I haven't shared any beers with Alan Shearer, much to my dismay. No, you spot those credentials that Matt's talking about there, and Stephen as well, in other ways, and in how they set about the game, how they set about preparing themselves, how they work with others in the team, I inspire them, lift them, etc. You know, and the way they talk to the fans as well. You know, okay, at that level, it'll be through the media or through other things, but. You know, that's the same. It's the same end result, probably just to a wider audience than it was in that bar at Exeter when Matt and Giovanni were sharing those ciders. But I think it's also the type of character. So he's a bit of a, as you say, he's been around several clubs, lower league and non-league as well. A journeyman, I guess you'd call him in many respects. But as the guys have said, when you find somewhere that feels right to you and you get that connection, it brings the best out of you, but also it gets that bond with the fans. And this is why players like this, we have huge respect for players like this who've had to sort of get up to this level the hard way, go and, you know, move from club to club, presumably not getting offered new contracts when one's come to an end. So he's had to fight for his career, probably. He's had to fight for recognition and fight to get a new club to call home, presumably a lot of the time knowing that that will be quite a short-term thing, which is just the realities of a lot of people's career at that level. You have huge respect for that kind of player, to show that you can still forge your way as a professional. A lot of people might give up when they're moving around non-league clubs and thinking, well, they're never going to make it to the Football League or make it as, well, you know, non-league might be professional at the higher levels, but it's you know, it's slightly more stable at League Two than it is at non-league. You know, he might be forgiven for, many people would probably throw in the towel and accept it's just not going to happen for them. But, you know, that determination, there are still people who forge a career there and then still end up later in their career rising up a bit higher. You know, not everyone turns into a Jamie Vardy. That's extreme. But to be able to get a few steps higher is very possible for those with the dedication and determination. But that's equally the characteristics that resonate most with fans. So as you say, the good bloke as well really, really helps. But the way he would go about his task on the field would show through those personal credentials as well. And that's where the fans end up falling in love with players like that, more so sometimes than the more skillful players, possibly, because they have characteristics that you can relate to a little bit. You can see that they don't have an otherworldly talent. You know, they're a little bit like the rest of us, just a little bit better at certain things. That gets them into this position, but they're always fan favourites, players like this.
Yeah, absolutely right. I think there's a consistent theme we had across the last series is, you know, I won't say all the selections, but certainly the majority of selections of players that were sort of chosen to go on Mount Rushmore weren't necessarily the best players, but they were players that fans appreciated for those very reasons that you guys have just mentioned. Okay, so Giovanni is going to be on Mount Rushmore. I'll try and find a space for a little glass of Thatcher's for him as well, because he deserves it from what you're saying, Matt. So let's do that one. So moving forward onto the forwards. Were we near misses on the forwards, Matt?
It was the most interchangeable and emotional. So at the beginning of every game we play at home and away, we sing a song for Stano, and I'm an old man, I'm 53, and it still makes my tear duct swell when we sing a song for Stano, we'll never let you go, because you'll always be at me with City. And it's really unusual in that other fans expect us to be shouting against them or some kind of, you know, banter, whatever. But every game we sing for him, and we have an enormous shirt of his. And he wasn't the greatest player. He was 110% hard on his sleeve player. Again, he reminds me of a Steve Bull. No, obviously not quite the same level of when Steve Bull played. But he scored for us to get us out of non-league oblivion. He was loved by the fans. He was Exeter through and through. His son now plays for Fulham, also a striker, and has played England, I think, under 18s, under 20s. He looks like his dad. And he's in the DNA of our club. We feel him every game, every time we go to the stadium, even when, again, we went to Wembley and one of the stands had the enormous shirt to him. And that's one of the magical things about Exeter City, that there's a player who you might not look at twice, but had a career giving absolute everything for City. And then, you know, it's terribly, sadly, he died, and his family still join us on the Big Bank, the biggest stand in league football. And it must really give them such a pride that even after a dozen years, we all sing a song for Stano. So he's my second choice. But for reasons I'll explain later, it's quite complicated because he's such a huge part of our club.
Yeah, I'll bet. This is Adam Stansfield.
Yeah, Adam Stansfield, yeah. Yeah, we got the Adam Stansfield stand, and we've got an Adam Stansfield Foundation. In fact, we've got a game, I think, next week where our coach is playing former players, local players, all to raise money for the Adam Stansfield, Stansfield Foundation.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a lot of football fans who appreciate those sort of things. I mean, I remember about Stephen Petrov at Aston Villa when he had leukemia, and lots of other clubs about players to lose players tragically early. So who was, I mean, Adam Stansfield obviously is a more than honourable mention. So who was your first choice then, Matt?
Well, the first choice is the guy whose money allowed us to buy the stand called Adam Stansfield. That's why I say it's interchangeable. Of course, it's Ollie Watkins. I mean, for Ollie, he was rejected from City under nines, started though under 11s. There's so much that I like about him. When I saw him play, you knew he would be a good player, but he's a player that you felt had to keep working at things. He went on loan to the mighty Western Supermare, but he's cleaning other people's boots. He's every time he comes on for England, we get money. So, for example, when he got on, when he started England, we got a maximum we get of 750,000, but we get 75,000 if he starts for England and 37.5 if he comes on as a sub. So, unlike Chelsea, some would say, the contract that Brentford and Villa have agreed have really helped us, but his character is what I love as much as anything else. Even when he was playing at Western Supermare, he was totally driven, totally dedicated. In fact, our current captain, called Matt Jay, and Ollie Watkins were sent off to Western Supermare as part of their development. And it kind of comes back to what you lads were saying earlier about Ethan Ampadu. I feel there was more mileage we could have given to Ethan's career. When Ollie left, I'd seen him for a couple of seasons. We all waved him off with our absolute best wishes. You've got a guy called Ben Crescent, who's now at Villa. We never even saw play once, and they snatched him up. But for Ollie, he saved our club in many ways financially. We've now got the cat and fiddle training ground being renovated because it's at the moment it's a pile of porta cabins. All of this is from Ollie Watkins' money. And the things that he left behind, the memories that I left behind, to be able to see him play for two seasons. He scored banging goals against Plymouth Argyle. I mean, what more do you need from a player in Devon when he scores bangers against Plymouth Argyle to beat them away in particular? So I've got a huge amount of time and respect for him. And I'm sure he had a hand in making sure that Exeter are still being supported to this day.
Yeah, but to you, Stevie, first, then I suppose there's almost a sort of massive contrast between the fates of Ethan Ampadu and Ollie Watkins, both in relation to what happened for Exeter and what happened in their careers. I mean, obviously Ampadu went straight to Chelsea, whereas Ollie Watkins went to Brentford first and then another step up to Villa with your guy, Stevie Gerrard. So, I mean, just sort of compare how those two things pan out, Steve, for both the club and the players.
I think the Ollie Watkins route is, I don't know, it's a route that's less taken nowadays. But, you know, to do it in terms of stepping stones, you know, you're moving on to Brentford. You know, Brentford, you know, were a team that were perennially, you know, tipped to reach the Premier League for a few years before they did. You know, and again, he's helped facilitate that for Brentford as well. So, you know, he's done this kind of like, you know, he's been a superhero for Exeter. He's been a superhero for Brentford. And then he hit the floor running at Aston Villa. Now, here's a player that, you know, I'd imagine a lot of the, probably most of the what they call the Big Six clubs have looked at some point. And then, you know, they've for whatever reason, decided not to take the plunge on him. But then, you know, every club that has just got wonderful, wonderful service from him. You know, he's clearly his backstory of how he's, you know, come back from rejection. You know, he's gone and played at Western Supermare. You know, it's just a brilliant story of how he's, you know, he's overcome what others saw to be his limitations. But, you know, his limitations have proved to be, you know, surmountable for him. And he's nailed every single rung of the ladder there, you know, to work his way all the way up to the England squad and clear to be in with a chance of going to a World Cup now. You know, it's a great story, and it's wonderful to hear that the knock-on benefits are still being felt by Exeter, that's a rare thing in itself for, you know, not even to be the most recent selling club. You know, it's the selling club but one, and still, you know, the benefit in now. And yeah, it's the lesser trodden path by players moving from, you know, lower league to upper divisions. But, you know, I think it's probably the more satisfying one if you ask the two players.
And that's a good point, Stiga. I suppose, as the richest club in the world, Aidan, I mean, can you see Ollie Watkins wearing the black and white stripe with the number 9 shirt? You know, it's a really good point, isn't it? That, you know, as well as the service he gave while playing for Exeter, his movements after his transfers afterwards has also gifted financial security to the club as well. I mean, that's like an extra level of dedication, isn't it?
Exactly, the gift that keeps on giving. That's the way enhance your appeal with the fan base that, that you've moved on from, or you've outgrown in terms of talent, I suppose, rather than in terms of affection. You know, Matt's talking there about how he stood out as a young player, and I guess that that made his abilities destined for something bigger than Exeter, which, yeah, you know, I correct me if I'm wrong, Matt, this would be my assumption, would be that there's a fair degree of pride in that for a fan base and a club at Exeter's level, that you've played a huge part in someone's career moving on. He's come through, obviously, the youth setup and moved on to become an England international. Now, that's going to be a rare thing for an Exeter City youth product, or anyone who's played for Exeter at any time. So I think the fact that his formative years, his development, his initial development came at Exeter would be a huge source of pride to see what he's achieving now. That kind of person leaving the club is, I would guess, something that you don't feel particularly sad about. I mean, you mentioned the phrase, you went off with all your well wishes. I would think that would definitely be the case, because it's patently obvious to everybody that he's destined for bigger things than a League Two club. And that's
exactly.
Yeah.
We all,
as much as you'd love to keep
time.
Him for a few years, and yeah, he'd score a few goals and fire you up another league, or maybe even another one after that.
Well, this
you know,
is the kind
that,
of...
That would have been lovely, I'm sure.
That would have been lovely, but the unique problem we have is we only actually aim to be a sustainable League One team, because we know that as a trust, then we're going to really struggle. We can't go to the basket case of the Championship. We'll never be able to compete, even if we go up next year with the Sunderland. We've got one player going to Sunderland already in our team. So it felt right for both sides, and it was such a kind of mutually respected decision. And, you know, everyone felt calm and proud, and it was good to be involved in, I have to say.
And now I'm sure that all Exeter fans are sort of following his career and following his appearances for England and cheering him on, taking, yeah, aside from the financial benefit, which might seem small fry to a lot of bigger clubs, but to a club at that level, it does pay for all sorts of things that that help keep the club going or help improve the club and
definitely
help push it on to the whatever level is the next one.
Yeah. I mean, to give you an idea, guys, yesterday Exeter played away at Carlisle and they couldn't afford two bus drivers. So it took them 10 hours to get there, and the players had to eat a KFC on the way because they weren't able to rotate the drivers. I mean, this is the level that we're at. When you can get that extra, hopefully £750,000, you know, it's unbelievably life-affirming for the club and life-changing for the future of the club. It's incredible. The coach was really fed up, considering they won in the 89th minute yesterday, that his players were queuing up at KFC at 6:30 on a Friday for a Saturday game because we couldn't afford two coach drivers.
It's interesting that, you know, we talk about you know, clubs travelling distances. Exeter to Carlisle. My God, that's a journey and a half, isn't it?
We took 400 fans as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to ask you all in a second to pick your Mr. Exeter from either from the guys Matt's chosen or from somebody else if you want to. But it's a sort of trivia question, and I'll throw it out to all of you to see if anybody can give me the answer. Who was the first, and I think so far only, Exeter player to appear in a World Cup final?
Oof. Goodness me.
The silence tells you everything, Gary.
Yeah. I'm going to get some stick for this one, Gary, when you tell me.
He was a referee. It's George Reader, I should say, who played for Exeter as a striker and refereed the 1950 World Cup final. Well, it wasn't the World Cup final as such, but it was in effect the World Cup final.
Anyway, I wasn't alive that time, get out clause. I'm going to use that one.
Well, neither was I, Matt.
No, luckily none of us were.
Anyway, so let's round it up by picking our Mr. Exeter. So, Matt, obviously, as the guest, you get the honour of going first, so you can choose either one of the guys you've chosen or somebody else if you so desire.
Yeah, well, it has to be, lads. I mean, this is probably illogical considering I selected Ollie Watkins, but Stano is the man that we think about every game, we sing about every game, whose family we support every game, whose son we follow at Fulham in England. So Stano is the man that gets the hairs on the back of my neck, even at 53. Gets the hairs on the back of my neck when we sing the song. So he's Mr. Exeter through and through. We love him and we miss him.
Stevie?
You can't go any further than that. That is, no, definitely the right choice there, without a shadow of a doubt.
Okay. Aidan?
I know, I feel terrible if I go against that now, with everything that's been described. If I to offer an alternative view, to pick from the four that we have chiseled now into Mount Rushmore, I would choose Giovanni Brown purely because of the connection.
Oh, fantastic. You'll be happy with that one.
Telling me he owes me a pint of cider when I make it down to Exeter.
Only one place in the Mount Rushmore. But I'm going to break protocol here, and I'm going to have a fifth one on Exeter City's Mount Rushmore, and we're going to add Adam Stansfield on as well, because I think that's only correct that we do that.
Brilliant. Excellent.
Okay. So massive thanks, Matt, for coming on and talking to us about Exeter City. And as I said before, you know, it doesn't matter whether it's you're talking about the best club in the world or the best club in England or the best club in Brockner Regis, it doesn't matter. It's your football club and that's important to you. So thanks for coming and talking about your football club and these players with such passion, Matt.
My pleasure, lads. I'm very proud to be associated, and my wife could probably get do with me talking about it a little bit less, but I'm incredibly proud.
Enjoyed it, Stevie?
Oh, an absolute ball. I've been lucky enough to go to Exeter's St. James Park. Infinitely better than Newcastle version. I was there for a few for the FA Cup game a few years back, what, 2016 or so it would have been. The Friday night at
that was a cold night.
It was a cold Friday night, and I think I'd worked the day before, and very little sleep, and then onto a coach, and done that trip, and it was one of the best away trips we've ever done. So this has been a joy. This.
Brilliant. Good stuff.
Final thoughts, Aidan?
Well, I have been to St. James's Park, but not that one. I've never ventured as far as Exeter, but, it's been fascinating to talk about. Because I said at the start, obviously, we don't get to hear about or know so much about a club like Exeter City because we're not associated or not following the same league. So it's really, really fascinating to delve into the stories, because every club, as you say, Gary, has these stories, and it's special to the people whose club that is. So it's absolutely terrific to hear it all. It's really pleasing, I think, to have found some characters who do resonate so well or have come through that club rather than just passed through, if you like. We've had a few good examples of that. So I think that's what really appeals. So it's been fascinating chat.
Right. Good stuff, lads.
Great really start to the series. Start to the series.
Thanks, lads.
Okay, thanks very much, guys. That's great. I just want to say thank you to the listeners for joining us on the first episode of Series 2 of Mount Rushmore. Catch us next time when we're looking at another club and some more players who deserve their plaque to be chiselled into Mount Rushmore above their particular club. This has been the Love Podcast from These Football Times. Thanks and goodbye.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Love, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists, and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.